Welcome to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. The Awakening Shalom Podcast is an opportunity for digital faith formation at Myers Park Baptist Church that accompanies the Awakening Series, a year-long journey of exploration and discernment which invites all people to come learn about the current social justice issues of the day and how they impact our faith. What we are awakening to is shalom, the Hebrew word for the peace and beauty that exists when we are living in right relationship with God, ourselves, other human beings, and all created things. Hello and welcome back to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. This is episode 3 and I'm back here with Bethany Johnson, professor of gender and women's studies, and we are diving into chapter 4 of the book, The Body Is Not an Apology by Sonia Renee Taylor. And this particular episode, we're going to show you all how to be good, nice, respectable Christians. What do you think, Bethany? Let's do it.
Yeah, let's nice ourselves into a total lack of justice.
Let's do that. Let's definitely get to a place where we're super nice, but everything we do is complicit in the structure of oppression.
Agreed. Okay. We have read Taylor's book.
We're really diving right into her book. And if I thought that this, the way chapter 4 starts of Taylor kind of crafting this vision of a world that works for everybody, which is such a cool way of saying it because she means every space body, not just a world that works for everybody. Yeah, is such a cool and almost, it's sort of a beautiful sort of eschatological, to use a theological term, teleological idea about what is the end that we're building. We're not just radical self-loving each other and ourselves because that's good. We're actually looking long-term toward a world that works for everybody. So we have a goal that we're working toward. And how do we get there? I saw that as very theological to me. It's sort of like kingdom or beloved community. You know,
I mean, you think that if someone had explained it to me that way when we were talking about the lion laying down with the lamb, I think it would have resonated more than, you know, understandably, because that's what scripture gave us, are a lot of agricultural and sort of pastoral analogies. But if someone had said this has to work for every space body, I would have been, let's think about that, you know, instead of being like, lions and lambs and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a really powerful metaphor.
And I think for Christians, the question's going to be, wait, you mean the world that works for every body? And what about non-Christian bodies? Is the world for them too? Or do you have to become a Christian body before the world starts to work for you and include you and care for you and love you? And I don't think that I just kind of to use Jesus's vision. I don't think Jesus's vision, you know, required this kind of necessary conversion to get the kind of rights within the new world of love and acceptance and community. And we often forget that as people of faith, as we start to look through what this world looks like. One of the controversial things, though, that she said to me was that this is not altruistic. I thought, you know, most Christians think, I'm working for the kingdom because that's a selfless thing to do. And Jesus told me to, like, be selfless and give of myself. And but actually, working for the kingdom is the most self-interested thing to do, too. That's, I think, where she's sort of flipping it on its head, right? Where actually radical – if you love yourself, then you love these other bodies – by loving these other bodies, you also love yourself. Like, it's all connected. There's
and
not
she's
this
saying
distinction.
You can't love other bodies unless you truly love your body. That's very counter to what I was taught growing up, which is that any self-love, we would have said, you know, self-acceptance or some of those other terms, which, you know, she categorizes as sort of weaker ideas of radical self-love, that doing that at all is selfish and that your call is to be selfless. And she's saying if you're selfless, you are disembodied, which is, you know, very much what we're saying this year is not a good idea. And she's saying if you're disembodied, you cannot love another body because you can't see another body because you don't even have a blueprint inside yourself to see a body.
Right.
And so that was really great for me to read, too, because, again, it's very counter to what I was taught mm-hmm. for years and years and all the way up through college about how I was to see myself. And I'm not talking, you know, like we've said this before, I'm not talking about like getting a pedicure for self-care. That's far less in depth than what she's calling us to do here. And I think what she's calling us to do has to be that in depth, or it cannot, you know, be like a rock in a pond and have these ripples that create
true
justice.
It's not radical if it doesn't go deeper below the surface.
To the root.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. This is where another one of those sort of ways we're taught get dismantled by her definition of radical self-love on 77. I think I just want to read this. This is my favorite paragraph of the book so far. I'm just going to read this, and I think we need to talk about what this means for us theologically and as church people and stuff. Dismantling oppression and our role in it demands that we explore where we have been complicit in the system of body terrorism, while employing the same compassion we needed to explore our complicity in our internalized body shame. Regrettably, this is where too many of us choose to exit the radical self-love train. Just love that it's a perfect analogy. She's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Lots of people getting ready to get off the train with us as they're listening to this podcast.
I'm all set.
Hold on to the train as long as you can. We desperately want our good intentions and niceness to be enough. Mm. Truth. Yeah. Although each of us is inherently enough to be loved, valued, cared for, and treated with respect, our efforts to raise systems of oppression and injustice will require more than our niceness. But I am a good person. I'm nice to everybody. Has never toppled one systemic inequity nor interrupted the daily acts of body terrorism leveled against humans throughout history. You are enough, but being good or nice is not.
Ooh, that is a real critique of the Christianity I was raised with.
Yes. Tell us about the Christianity you were raised with, Bethany.
So
I blame your pastor.
As a female, my call was to have, you know, a very specific role. It would be, you know, in concert with the very traditional male role. But
that sounds like complementarianism, just to use a word.
Complementarianism.
Okay, good.
Although I would say the complementarianism in my church required me to not have a voice at all. And if you read complementarianism, there is at least the claim that people both have a voice. They just have different roles or different types of power within that exchange. And here, again, I think is where niceness and words like grace can really cover up where we're telling people, I don't want to hear your story. I don't want to hear your voice.
Even
stop
kindness.
Taking up space. Even kindness.
Theological language, right? Like nice isn't a Greek word.
Right.
Kindness is, right? And so we use them like interchangeably.
Yeah.
But I think it's okay. Like, complementarianism means that you should just, like, it's a quiet voice. You have a voice, but it's like a, I don't want it to be too loud, and I don't want it to, like, make me feel bad as a man. So if it could be, like, quiet.
And, you know, if it could never say anything truthful that would make me have to look at maybe how my behavior impacts others, that would also be great. And if you could make sure that you're definitely not showing any way that you could potentially be smarter than me, that would also be nice.
Well, truth is not supposed to come from, like, male, like female to male, isn't it? Is it supposed to come mostly, like, from male to accountability buddy?
Right. So theologically,
other male.
I don't know, you know, if we go back to Aquinas, can women know the truth, Ben?
It's up for debate still, I think, in America. Let's talk about it, you know? Can women earn as much as a man? Can women assert their autonomy? Can women be in control of their bodies?
Can they be paid as much if they don't speak with a loud voice?
Can they be CEOs? Can they be president?
Not if they're not being nice.
No, they need to be nice. I mean, that's what Hillary's problem was, right? Like,
she
didn't get elected.
She wasn't nice.
Because she's not nice. Because what we really want is a nice president.
Right. We don't want, if I hear
this is where it goes,
voice,
right?
Right. It's like, well, her voice isn't, you know, like, I don't hear people saying that about men's voices. The second that I get too strong in my opinions or I have a, where I say no, you know, just a direct no, all of the sudden I am trespassing across what my role is meant to be. And that was very deeply ingrained that I was supposed to be nice. I know how to modulate my voice when I'm losing my audience.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about it. The problem must be in men's ears. Let's be clear. suddenly when you start telling the truth, in my ear, it gets really shrill.
It's like a high-pitched ringing.
It's not your voice that changes. It's the truth that... It's always in the ear. I mean, if you read the parables, Jesus is never like, yeah, sometimes I might be lying to you. So check what I'm saying. No, he's like, the problem's in the soil. It's in your ears, dude. You're not listening. Like, that's the problem. but they do this to women preachers a lot. Mm-hmm. And I say they as in we all do this. Like Chrissy talks a lot about how she had to do some vocal coaching mm-hmm. when she first started preaching. And she was asked to do that because folks didn't like her voice.
And I've heard of this on This American Life, journalists talking about the amount of vocal fry they have, which mm-hmm. is a certain frequency.
Yeah.
And they were playing side-by-side clips of male and female voices that had the same amount of vocal fry. And then they were reading emails, and they only got them about the female voices. So it really is a literal reaction to female voices, but we have to back that up and say, why is that? Because female voices historically are supposed to only tell us what we want to hear and only be encouraging and, you know, and nice. And I think we mix up niceness with kindness, right? And that sometimes what is kind should be bringing about justice, and that doesn't always feel nice.
We don't want our female minister or preacher or teacher or professor or politician telling us about economics mm-hmm. or something that's hard
or
to
science.
Hear. Science or politics or mm-hmm. religion. Or something really difficult about poverty, you know, or racial injustice. Mm-hmm. We don't, that's not really, is that really a woman's role to tell us about those things? Like, shouldn't we have an expert man come in and give us a seminar about racism so that we can hear it?
You would think that we have moved past that, and we really haven't.
We have not. We have not. We're still wrestling with this, which is why niceness doesn't work. Niceness is it's a tyranny. It really is like it's a tyranny that we force on particular bodies that are experiencing oppression, and we expect them to respond with niceness. And so we say, well, could they just, if you weren't so angry, maybe you'd get more with honey than with, what do they say, with a stick or with vinegar, more with honey than vinegar, more with a carrot than a stick. Like, just if you could be a little nicer and more respectful.
And I think white women, you know, I can speak for myself and certainly many of the people that I've seen, particularly in social media spaces, which I study, white women love to tone police women of color, particularly black women.
Right.
Like, you know, you don't have to be so angry about it. Or maybe if you tried being nice, like what you are doing is you are vomiting out the oppression that you have internalized. And now you're visiting it on another body.
Yeah.
Because you've been told that you only get to be in the room if you're nice. And now you're going to do that to somebody else.
Right.
And, you know, you see a lot of activists and black women saying, I'm not going to be nice to you about my oppression.
Right.
Stop
right.
asking me to do that, you know? Yeah. And then white women pack up their backpack and they leave the space and they exit the discussion.
Right.
And so that is another problem with niceness. If niceness is your highest value, you get to leave as soon as anyone's being nice and you don't have to hear the truth.
Well, I had a counselor, and I'm not going to say who it is, but I had a counselor come to me and say, you know, I went to this recent session on racial justice, and an African-American woman spoke really strongly and was angry, and I didn't feel like I could get a word in edgewise, and this counselor said, I could never do counseling like that with couples when I don't allow couples to talk to each other like that in counseling. And I just had this great moment. It was one of those great pastoral moments mm-hmm. where you say something without thinking and it just comes out. And I said, well, what if you had an abused wife coming in with an abuser? You're not going to expect the abused wife to be nice, are you?
Nice.
And like not angry. Right. Are you going to expect that? You're going to tell that you never tell
it?
The abused wife to tamper down the fact that she's been hurt. Now you're telling – that's the same as telling somebody who's experienced 400 years of oppression, could you be nice so that we can talk through this?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I need you to be nice to me about the way that I'm oppressing you.
Right. It's
not doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. You can't get through anything really that way. It's, again, this – it's another way of putting this sort of – facade over top of the pain and trying to move forward without doing any real reconciliation. It's mm-hmm. like, let's just put it behind us. Let's talk it through to a point where you're not angry anymore, even though nothing's changed. Right. So we can just move
and
forward with our lives.
And
I feel comfortable because you're not yelling anymore.
Right. And to be clear, we're not speaking out against kindness or grace here. I think what you and I are in agreement on and what we're in agreement on with Taylor is that using terms like kindness or grace to keep the systems intact so we don't have to feel uncomfortable is violence.
Right. That's right. Well, and I think it's pretty clear that we have used niceness now as a theological lens, not just to oppress women, but to water down our entire Christianity, which is probably the result of the fact that we've sort of made Christianity a woman's thing and men get to keep going
right.
out in the world in the mm-hmm. sort of separate spheres and killing people and making lots of money. And women get to do the religious thing with raise children and take care of them.
Yeah, be the spiritual hearth of the home.
So it's not surprising, right, that then Christianity has become very domesticated.
Yeah.
So when we say, well, Christians should be nice to what that pastor said, what to you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Pastors don't get to say that to people because they're not supposed to be really nice to everyone, right? Because that's right. what Jesus was, really
well,
nice.
Why is that pastor getting so political?
Yeah.
As a way of saying, this person made me uncomfortable. They're making me face things that I'm not comfortable with.
Right.
And that's another way of saying they're not being nice.
Every time that comes up, that's an indication that we have watered down our Christianity to the point where it's almost indistinguishable from a pagan, worldly, New Age philosophy of just be chill with each other. Mm. Because Jesus is constantly doing what Taylor is doing, which is exploring his and other people's complicity in systems of shame and honor around bodies within their society, whether they're sick bodies, women's bodies, tax collector bodies, prostitute bodies. You can just go on and on and on and on and on. Oppressed bodies, poor bodies, whatever. And he's pretty laser focused on his work of including those bodies and providing honor to bodies that have been shamed. And he's pretty rough with those. He calls them hypocrites constantly. Mm-hmm. I've never heard anybody who called people hypocrites called nice.
True.
Jesus has entire chapters where all he says is, woe to you, woe to you, woe to you. If these things had been done in this town, they would have been burned to death by God. You know, like judgment sometimes is not out of bounds for some of the things that Jesus says. We need to think about theologically, what does that mean? There's a lot of strong words to Pharisees and Sadducees. There's lots of strong words to those in political power and leadership and religious power. Jesus is not nice to them. He's not nice when he comes into the temple.
No.
And people don't know what to do with that.
The Pharisees were doing everything right. They were the people that were
right.
following all the rules, had it figured out, were the examples for
Jesus
everyone
says
else.
They were tithing 10% or more of their income back to the church. So they were, of course, doing everything right, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet
yeah.
it was still participating in systems of oppression that they were not willing to tear down because that were excluding particular people and bodies from community.
Because if they did, they wouldn't be at the top of the pile anymore.
That's right.
And Jesus could smell that a mile away. You know, and I know pagan people who, in that tradition, they're very radical about justice.
Mm.
But because they have a different belief structure, there are a lot of people who will say, well, I can just throw out all of your systems change ideas because I don't agree with how you practice your belief system.
Right. That's right.
Where we're not willing to look at other systems and say, oh, there's something going on over there that we should actually be thinking about doing ourselves.
Sure. Right. That's right.
You know.
Well, it's all sort of like then we think we're purists. Again, this is all this, a lot of Christian supremacy here, right? Because
mm-hmm.
we think we're the pure ones that have this pure thinking straight from Jesus, when in reality our thinking comes through Jesus, but then Cicero comes in to give us just law with Augustine, and then Aquinas brings Aristotle in and baptizes Aristotle. So we have all that Western Greek thinking about women being inferior that we baptize in the part of the church, and we've got these pagan
mm-hmm.
What we would call them, they're really just good Greek philosophical traditions, pagan philosophical traditions that we baptize, and then we get really judgy when liberation theologians want to use Marx, and we're like, well, wait a second, we're good with Aristotle, but we're not good with your use of Marx.
Right.
All Aristotle was somebody who gave us systems mm-hmm. to look at and think through how our theology impacts a world of systems. It's the same way Marx operates. And so we mm-hmm. somehow think that there's like this pure Christian truth that comes straight from the Bible to us in the 21st century. But everything has
been. And it didn't have thousands of years of
philosophical traditions, all these other things wrapped up into it. And so we have to be. And I just think that this, we are condemned to niceness. I had one of my professors said that the most important thing that Christians should do is, and particularly pastors, need to free themselves from sentimentality and free the church and liberate the church from the tyranny of sentimentality. This is the idea that we get up and I tell you a smarmy story about how my daughter Lucy painted a picture of God, and it was just so beautiful. It gave me a new definition of who God is, and now I treat everybody else nice because of this picture that my daughter taught you. And you know, now we have this just—it's just so beautiful and sentimental, and that's going to make your life better. And then, what you don't want to hear is me get up and be like, "Hey, we're not taking care of the poor real well," you know?
Right.
And here's how we could do it. So I think there's a wrestling.
I can put myself in that too. I've definitely, over the years, as I've been thinking about these ideas, and when I started first thinking about justice, and we'll talk about our racial stories later in another podcast. But, you know, if I think about all of the ways I did not like to feel challenged, this was my story too. I didn't like to be challenged by people that I later found out I was oppressing because I was also experiencing oppression.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that niceness also glides over, that you can be oppressed and also oppress. Because if people are being nice, we just don't have to think about any of that. And if you're telling the story, this very beautiful story about a daughter's painting, people can still be dying right outside of your church, and we don't have to engage that.
That's right. It's like that great scene in Borat where I can't believe I'm referencing Borat right now, where he sleeps out in front of a mega church.
Oh, yeah.
And he, like, pretends he's homeless. And then, like, people just walk over him.
Like
literally.
Step over.
To get into their church.
Right.
And then he goes in and worships with them and gets saved. Right? Like, yeah, it's just... It's beautiful.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. Beautiful. Like, if you'll become Christian, we'll love you and we'll take care of you. But if you're out on the front step, like right there, 3 feet away, you're nothing to us.
Literally
we're going to step over you to come in.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of us are doing that in our church. Well, anyway, so we're moving from niceness. Mm-hmm. So we have to move out of that. So what do we move to? I think the thing that's so amazing to me is this analogy that we have. It's like learning another language to free ourselves from body terrorism, to dismantle these structures, both internally inside of ourselves and externally out in the world. We have to, this is how I would put it, we have to unlearn the language that we were taught as children and growing up of body terrorism so that we can learn a new language of radical self-love. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, I just think that's a fantastic analogy.
And it's so important to think that we have learned a language. And that's why we just spent so much time talking about nice, right? Just that
idea. We learned
idea.
The language of niceness.
We learned that language. And we can't learn a new language until we first identify that we have one that we have learned. And that it does things, that language,
right?
So, and this is what this book is all about. You and I were talking earlier about implicit and explicit bias. What does she say about implicit bias that really struck you?
Well, when she talks about implicit bias, I thought that there's this line on 80 where she says, implicit bias proves that just as we have internalized messages of body shame, so too have we been willful and unintentional agents of body terrorism. So it's like that's sort of how we – implicit bias is like part of the language that we learned, right? Certain things may have become explicitly inappropriate in society, you know, like saying the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
But internally, it's okay for me to still think that.
Right.
Right.
And
so I have this implicit sense of white superiority that I all live with. I might not explicitly say these negative words.
No, I'm not supposed to explicitly say.
Right. So I've learned what I've learned. I've been conditioned now to learn what is publicly okay. But I have not kind of retrained or relearned a new internal language that will then help me live completely different. You know?
Moving here from the north has been really interesting because I think there's this assumption on both sides that, you know, the South is the problem where there's still a lot of racism and the South sees the North as a place that is also racist and not in touch with it. And I would say the difference is really that since I've moved here, I would say I still hear a lot of things that are sort of explicitly racist but coded, you know, like, oh, well, that neighborhood is, well, you know what I mean. Like, yeah, you just said a lot right there.
Right.
A lot of things were just said.
Right.
And in the north.
That was a real estate agent, probably.
Yeah. Wow, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But also, like, people that come and fix your toilet and you know, you hear from a lot of people. But in the North, I think people are very clear on what you don't say externally, but there's very little internal work.
Yeah.
And people get very angry when you start talking about that internal work because they know how to be nice on the surface. Mm-hmm. But that heart work, that changing of the heart isn't there. And I think there's this, you know, when we're talking about bias, we've had explicit bias all in history. And if you look at the South as an example, and even the North up until the 1820s, you had these legal characterizations of how much blackness people had, mm-hmm. right? So you could be mulatto, you could be octoroon, you could be an eighth. You know, you had all the way up to a tenth. And this was legally written into the codes, and it impacted how much people were sold for in the North mm-hmm. and in the South. One of the biggest exchanges of enslaved goods, for example, is New York City. You know, it had the biggest cotton market outside of Charleston, or I think. And then you also see this in the UK, and you see this in Germany in World War II. How right. Jewish are you?
Right.
How far back does that go?
Is your mother Jewish or your father Jewish? Right. Yeah.
Do you have a maternal grandmother and a paternal grandmother? Because that makes you more Jewish. Yeah. And then we can put you in this situation. And so those are explicit things. But when we made those explicit biases illegal, that didn't automatically mean that we got rid of all of our implicit yeah. bias.
Well, you just stole the entire story of the Civil War to Jim Crow. Because
right,
that's what
right.
happened in Reconstruction is mm-hmm. that we changed the laws in the South, but then the Union kind of went back to running a country instead mm-hmm. of sort of imposing martial law in the South
right.
and left the South to its own devices. And the very systems of oppression were recreated in new ways
absolutely.
In Reconstruction through KKK, lynching, Jim Crow laws, and other forms of legalized
chain
oppression.
Gangs, bonded service,
gangs.
You know?
Yeah, that's
it
right.
It says you can enslave someone if they
right.
commit
if they're a criminal.
Crime.
Well,
that's
just,
still in our Constitution.
Just arrest them. Just
sure.
get the corrupt police force to arrest them, you
right.
know,
because
the police are all white people. So just get the white people to round up some African Americans and put them in jail. I think that this – this gets really to the later part of the book where she deals with that – really difficult tension between changing laws and changing hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses that great Clinton quote where Clinton goes one way on one issue and back to the heart on the other issue. On one issue, he's like, it's about laws, not hearts. And the other issue is, it's about hearts, not laws.
Yeah.
And politicians are perfect at like figuring out which one they want to go to
that they think
is easier.
Mm-hmm.
That they can commit to, right? In some cases, it is easier to change laws than hearts. Like,
mm-hmm.
right, Civil War, we come, we put flags in your churches, and we tell you you have to deal with the Union, and here's what the laws are, and then we leave, and your hearts are not changed at all. In fact, you have this bitter lost cause.
From what happened.
You create this
yeah.
whole bitter lost cause.
And
very
you start
similar.
Calling it the War of Northern Aggression for
right.
100 years.
It's very similar to like Germany post-World War One, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so
mm-hmm.
Germany feels like they had to pay reparations for the war that they weren't the only ones that were involved in just because they lost. And then suddenly from there, we're 30 years later in the midst of a time where they're killing millions of Jewish
people.
People
are so primed for Hitler because he basically did the – I'm not making a direct comparison between our president and Hitler. I'm not doing that. I think that is sloppy.
Yeah.
What I am going to say is that there was a similar environment in which people felt poor or forgotten, except it was the whole country of Germany, not pockets.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to come and give you your dignity back. I'm going to reopen the factories. We're going to make munitions, even though it's against the peace treaties at the end of World War One. I'm going to give you your job back. And when people stopped being hungry and started having jobs, they were really looked the other way. And I think we have the same risk now that if we have...
We're not the worst people on earth. We're the best.
Right, right. And then we can look the other way when we're putting children in camps at the border and separating them from their parents.
This is just what we have to do now.
Right. And, but now people have jobs and the government shutdown is over for a time. And, you know, things are going back to normal and let's just all be nice to each other.
What's a few concentration camps if we're all working? You know, I think, it's exactly the same kind of rhetoric. And it's the same as what happened in the South after the Civil War.
Yeah.
It's like they needed these redemptionist politicians came and said, we need to redeem the South. There's a redemption here. But what redeem meant is return.
Right.
To the way it was.
Absolutely.
Power structure back to the place where whites were in charge. There wasn't fusion politics happening between poor whites and poor blacks. And this is where white supremacy sort of is literal political parties, white yeah. supremacist party, mm-hmm. you know, are running for office in the South in yeah. turn of the century, right? And, you know, it's this idea when you're – this the lost cause idea really is what sort of is at the root of it. Germany lost cause, mm-hmm. South after Civil War lost cause, America post-recession lost cause. We've been forgotten. We are yep. – or we're looked down upon mm-hmm. Or
we
we've been bullied.
We need to get our dignity back.
And so how do we get it back? Well, through right. brute force.
Right. And by making sure, to your point a couple podcasts ago, that we get to be more equal than someone else.
That's right. That's right.
That is how we will feel good again, and that is the opposite of radical self-love.
Absolutely.
That's why she wants us to get back to loving ourselves and not being totally self-evacuated and disembodied, because if we actually love ourselves, we cannot visit that violence on others.
Yeah. I mean, that gets right into this beautiful quote on page 83 from Lilla Watson that she uses, that you and I were just talking about how it's a face melter earlier. if you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. If you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. Mm. I just think that is so helpful. White people need to repeat that quote to themselves over and over and over again. Our job is not to go out and help people.
Absolutely.
Our job is to realize that our liberation is mutually tied with everyone else's.
That we too need to be liberated
yeah.
from this system of whiteness that we found ourselves inside. And I think what people misunderstand, and where I see a lot of resistance from people that I talk to about these issues in classes or otherwise, is that adopting this, understanding that you too need to be liberated, actually takes some of the pressure off, because it's not your job to save everything and
right.
everyone all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You get
Stop
to do it
Stop with that
together.
White man's burden crap.
Yeah.
You know?
Give yourself some more time and energy and space by distributing that activity.
Right.
And also be willing to just listen for when you're going to meet this person who says, you know, if you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, you actually have to listen to what that other person's liberation sounds like.
Right. Yeah.
And looks like.
It's sort of like what we said earlier. Actually, it turns out those at the heart of intersecting oppressions can show us the way out.
Yeah.
Can show the people who've been the beneficiaries of oppression, right? Those who have gained advantage through historic oppression, like myself, white, male, cisgendered, you know, mm-hmm. heterosexual dude, right? My way into my liberation is through black queer women. Like,
right.
that's it for me. I should be reading nothing but black queer women, probably,
right.
which is the opposite of what, you know, most of my theological
Absolutely.
History has been, which is white German men, right?
And, yeah. and I have to do the same thing,
yeah.
right? If I ever have a feeling where I need to say, you know, I don't like how you said that, all that is a signal to me that I'm using the way I've been oppressed and I'm about to oppress another person. And the best,
yeah.
most just thing I can do is to be quiet, not to ask for them to be nice.
Right.
It will never be nice for someone to say, this is how I'm oppressed, this is how I have to get free. That will be on fire, whatever that is said.
Right.
And we have to be okay with that.
Yeah, one of our church members, when I asked her, she'd been doing a lot of personal work on racial issues and whiteness and racism after participating in the Awakening, going on a pilgrimage, and she said something really profound to me. And she said, what I'm learning is I need to get tougher with hearing the story and my participation in it, right? I need to get a little tougher about hearing that. And then I also need to be quiet more often.
Mm,
those two things are like that's like the key path.
Yeah.
Quiet, be not talk every time you have the opportunity, and get tougher with hearing these hard truths that we don't want to hear, that are really uncomfortable mm-hmm. and make us feel guilty and fragile and all the other white stuff that comes out of us. I mean, it's I think this is one of the things that she leaves us with when she gets into the changing hearts section is, it's not enough just to say, okay, these folks are creating body terrorism, so let's flip the game and we'll all become body terrorists towards those bodies. So now the fat
right.
get to oppress the skinny, right.
right?
And, you know,
women will boss men around.
Women
and,
will boss
you know,
men around and oppress men for a couple generations to
right.
make it equal. And
right.
let's put let black people enslave us for a couple generations.
Right.
Like, I think that's like when people hear reparations, particularly white
yeah.
people, when
yeah.
people hear reparations,
100%.
They think that that's what we need, 400 years of slavery, white slavery. mm-hmm. right? When it's not really about that.
And that's the moment when you know that deep down on a cellular level, we all know how evil it really was. Or yeah. We wouldn't be afraid of
it. Why would we be afraid?
Right. Because
what's
people
wrong with
like, they were part of their families on these plantations. Oh, okay. Do you want to do that for a couple hundred years? No.
Sound
why?
Good? Yeah.
But you could just be part of the family with a few extra chores.
Yeah. Actually, there are some scholars who say that. Like, just do you want to be black?
Right.
You know, then you'll know why there's a problem, right? You know?
And that's not a nice thing to say.
Exactly. It's not a nice thing at all to say. Well, and I think that's why you have to have an alternative vision. She uses this sort of story of labor rights activist Grace Lee Boggs to talk about how mm-hmm. it's not about like flipping oppressors to oppressed and mm-hmm. oppressed to oppressors. That's not – you have to have an alternative vision of the world to go back to a world that works for everybody. Mm-hmm. And you have to have this kind of like kingdom or beloved community or shalom or whatever your vision is of what right relationship and harmony, peace is with all bodies. You have to have that vision and you work toward that vision. And you know that just because you get power doesn't mean you then sort of suddenly use it to oppress those who are oppressing you, because you're not making that world possible then.
Right.
You know, what you really want is equality. And we're just trying to get there.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that vision, though, what happens is that very system starts to happen. Those who come out of being oppressed turn into the oppressors and vice versa. I mean, that's – you can use the story of the Irish, story of Christianity.
Right.
Right? Christians were poor.
And that's why I don't buy – you know, people are like, we need more women in politics because it'll be nicer. Have you heard this? And I'm like, A, no, and B, no.
Yeah.
We need more women in politics because there are women yeah. alive on the planet, and I would like it to have demographic representation. We need women in politics because women, too, are smart and savvy and interesting and yeah. have good ideas. Women are not nicer. We are socialized to be nicer.
Right.
But we will still be very, 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 very cutthroat. And anyone that thinks differently doesn't know any women.
Exactly. I was going to say, do those people don't know the women that I know.
Right.
You know, I do podcasts with women who come at me, and I don't know. It's you got to be okay with yourself afterwards. I can tell you from doing Chrissy's podcast with Chrissy, and now with you. Get ready. These women are not nice.
Been.
You know what was that thing they called Hillary? She was a nasty woman.
Nasty.
And
woman.
Then people like made those shirts.
Oh yeah.
That's who we're dealing with.
Right.
Okay.
Just surrounded by
nasty
women.
And that's who I want
women.
In charge. That's who I want in charge. So let's get into these unapologetic agreements that she leaves us with at the end. We want to leave these with you as your challenge, leaving this podcast here as we
and
move.
And this gets us beyond niceness to actual dismantling. So these are really good steps for readers to look for at the end of chapter 4
yeah.
because it gives you some concrete ideas about how you can start acting out this radicality, which is what we've talked about before, in their life and deal with these implicit biases. And a lot of it is language-based,
yeah.
what she's dealing
well,
with.
Well, niceness is mostly, just to set this up, I love the way you set that up, niceness is like an equivocation, right? Almost,
mm-hmm.
And it's usually sometimes there's like a lie at the root of it,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we're actually not being nice to people usually when we're nice to them because
mm-hmm.
we're not telling them the truth. And the
right.
truth is the nicest thing that you can do to somebody is to tell them the truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's walk through these. You want to start?
Okay, so be a shame, body shame free friend.
Mm.
I love, love, love this. And this is hard to figure out if you grew up like me and you're a real champion body shamer, which I'll talk about next podcast. But
champion body shamer.
Just Olympian body shamer. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, when someone says something like, oh, I look so fat in this, or, you know, I can't wear that because I'm X, or I'm, you know, white pants after Labor Day, blah, 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 blah. It's hard to – you're not going to have a statement that convinces somebody in that moment. You can say, hey, your body's not an apology. Why don't you wear what you want? But you can also say something that I say to people is, I don't see that about you.
Oh, I don't see that about you.
And I'm not offering them another narrative because that's not my job. They have to come up with their narrative about themselves, but I can reject –
right.
No,
I'm not saying, actually, you're so skinny.
Right. Because then you're
then
saying skinny's
actually
the
saying
best
skinny's
thing
great.
To me.
You should
right.
be that. Yeah.
Right. So if that's what I've started doing recently. I don't see that about you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe talk about some other things that aren't related to that specific thing they're talking about. But mm-hmm. what would happen if, you know, there's a wound at the center of any conversation when someone's like, I would wear that too if my legs looked like that.
That's a wound.
Just a gaping. There's a sinkhole in the middle of your interaction now.
Wounded animals are the most violent too.
Wow, that was a whole sermon right there.
That's so true. Hurt people hurt people. Yeah. That's I've preached that before. Well, I love that. I could use some more body shame free friends. I'd love for them to come my way.
Then you know what? Hair, glasses, it's all just right.
That's great. What I see about it's so you. Good. Thanks, Bethany. I feel very affirmed right now. Let me figure out if I can love myself now. You said that. I'll work on that. All right. Number two is engage and encourage curiosity-driven dialogue, not debate or arguing.
Okay, so this is my question for you, and this is what I wrestled with this one, because I kept coming back to that James Baldwin quote about how we can dialogue until you decide I don't have the right to exist or I don't exist. And I think about this particularly when we talk about the bathroom bill and things like that. You can't have a dialogue if you start with one person being like, I don't believe in trans people.
No.
So I think that's kind of the caveat to this, curiosity-driven dialogue. But for me, I kind of have to back out of the conversation when I start hearing so-and-so is not real, so-and-so doesn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, a slave and slave master can't have a dialogue about freedom.
Right.
And neither can Nazi guard and Jewish concentration camp personnel. And the same is true through all history of oppression. Like, if I don't really think... If I really don't think women should be in charge, I really don't believe that. We can't really even start a dialogue.
Right.
You know, what we can dialogue about, if I believe that, is what does it look like? Mm-hmm. And how does it feel? And what is that going to mean for me? Those are honest questions. Mm-hmm. But what's not going to work is if I'm like, I'm not really sure trans people are real or should exist or are not just an aberration
of
sin.
Or mentally ill.
Yeah, they're mentally ill.
Like, okay, well then
they need
we
to go
can
to
both
camp.
Be curious, but we can't dialogue. And if you think, you know, it's disgusting to have a fat body and that person should do X, then you can't really talk about the liberation of the body. So you can still be respectful, but I don't know if you can have a dialogue at that point.
Right. Well, it's interesting how weight and race, weight and poverty, for instance, more closely align for... to this question of personal responsibility versus systems of injustice. I mean, it's like, oh, well, you know, they're overweight because they have no self-control. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're overweight.
They wouldn't drink so much soda.
Right. Yeah. Or eat so much Burger King.
Right. And you're like, let's talk about the price of organic broccoli and a Whopper.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Food deserts or just body issues, dietary issues that people have, diseases that people might have, medical conditions.
They wouldn't have health disease if X.
Right.
Like, but they also happen to
be
poor.
We do this with health.
Oh, so much.
Even not with weight, right? We do it with like, oh, well, I'll tell you why they got cancer. Mm-hmm. Look what they eat, you know, or look what they smoke.
Like, that's we also can't tie cancer directly to what we put in our bodies at this time. And if we ever can, then what we should be saying is, how do I systemically change it so this person is not forced to get cancer because of lack of access to healthy food?
Right.
Instead of, well, you know, they should act.
Yeah, and there can't be like only carcinogen foods in their neighborhood.
Right.
It should be our responsibility from a public health perspective to make sure they have access to healthy food. I think we have to start there. But then this question about dialogue, to me, I think she's saying like, how do we engage in conversation? The term I've thought about is appreciative inquiry, which is this sort of like term Christian theologians use. And some researchers, like, my goal is not to tell you and change your mind about something. Mm-hmm. My goal is to just listen and hear and try to give the best reading of what you're saying. Mm. You know, even if you're not even really articulating it the way that I expect it to be articulated or that I've heard it before, mm-hmm. I want to give the best read of what you just communicated. So like I do this sometimes in talkback when we're doing that after worship on a Sunday, somebody will say, well, don't you think Jesus just, and I'll be like, I'll restate their premise in a way that I think is the most appreciative possible way of saying what they said.
Right.
Tie it to a theologian or a scholar who may have said the same thing and try to deal with it as a legitimate critique.
Yeah.
Not just a one-off shot in the dark or
– Yeah, I do that in the classroom too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say you know, I've heard so-and-so talk about that, and that was definitely the way it was approached in this time period.
Right.
Now we might look at differently because of X, and we didn't know why before, so now we might come to Z conclusion. So you can take it seriously. Yeah.
I think that's what she means.
Yeah.
So do that. Yeah. and in order to do that, of course, we have to embrace multiple perspectives, which is sort of number three. Mm-hmm. Which I think is obvious. I don't know if we have to say much more about that.
So what she does say is, even if every cell in your body disagrees with someone's perspective, remember that making people bad and wrong will never build connection and understanding. And earlier in the book, she talks about remembering that you are not your thoughts. So as you continue to body shame yourself, you can talk about how that's a systemic and outside thing that you have learned. And it's important probably to remember that when we're talking with people who really disagree,
right.
they're communicating something to me that they have internalized, that they have learned. They, at their core, are not a bad person.
Yeah, they're not wrong bodies and they're not bad bodies.
Right.
They're just bodies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, number four is have compassion for and honor people's varied journeys, which I think is really important, particularly if their journey is different from ours, then we should not imagine that we can kind of lay our journey on top of theirs as a better narrative.
Absolutely. Expect and accept discomfort.
But wait, I want to be nice, and I want to receive niceness.
I want everyone to just hold hands and sing Kumbaya, which is a lovely song.
It is a nice song.
I think expecting and accepting discomfort is the only thing that, you know, that's your first step to breaking down these systems.
That's right.
That's basic. It's not easy, but it's foundational.
Right. And I think that there is no community that you'll be a part of that does good work in the world that does not expect you to experience some level of discomfort in the work that you're going to do. Otherwise, they're not changing the world. Mm-hmm. Number six is acknowledge intent while addressing impact. I thought this was interesting. Yeah.
I think this is really what people like myself, white, cis women, need to really work on.
Uh-huh.
Because we have been taught that we need to be nice and that's our role.
Yeah.
When we come into a space and we're trying to be nice and that's not received well because it's actually oppressive behavior, we get really upset, we take our ball and go home.
Yes.
Because intent and impact are not the same thing. I can intend not to hurt someone with my words. I have friends that are black women and they are welcome to tell me, like, that was messed up. And my response should be, yep. And I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is how I will address it going forward, you know.
I think that's such an important lesson for white folks to distinguish intent from impact. And also for those who are trying to do anti-racist work with white folks to remind themselves of the good intents that are there and to acknowledge good intent. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, feeding the homeless is a great thing. Does it sometimes replicate systems of injustice?
Yeah.
Yeah. Your impact might not necessarily be just the thing that you thought you were doing, which is giving somebody a meal. Mm-hmm. You know, you may also be replicating certain kinds of social service systems that keep people impoverished, you know?
Right.
So just because you feed, your intent was good, doesn't mean the impact of your intentions doesn't play out in the world differently. There's this great Michel Foucault quote about this. I want to see if I can get this right.
Foucault, nice. You worked Foucault in.
Yeah.
I'm proud of us.
Well, I'm trying to impress you as a scholar. And that's the only reason I ever quote Foucault is to impress someone. But Foucault says, we usually know what we do. Sometimes we know why we do it. But we don't know what we do does.
Whoa. Yes. That is good.
Isn't that amazing?
That's really good.
He's so good.
If people are struggling with this, it helps me to think about times in my life where intent and impact were different on the receiving end. Sometimes, you know, that's the only way we can put ourselves in someone else's shoes. So I remember when I was getting infertility treatment and really kind, well-meaning people would say, just relax.
That's the favorite one for folks dealing with infertility.
Oh, totally. And I was like, oh, does that open your fallopian tubes? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah. Does that make you ovulate on schedule?
Does that make you produce more eggs?
Right.
Cool. All I need is a massage.
If only I had known.
I should just get more massages.
I heard.
We can have like 30 kids if I just got more massages.
Would you like to sponsor my massages?
Yeah.
So I can relax?
You could pay for my massage instead of my IVF.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
let's do that.
I had people tell me to go on a cruise because they had a cousin that got pregnant when they finally went on a cruise. And I was like, oh, okay. That should, all right. Cool.
That's about as good advice as have sex with a different partner.
Right, exactly. Also heard that. Do you want some of my do not finish that statement. Why were people saying this to me in public?
Oh my God.
But that was one of those moments where the intent was the person was feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They were trying to say something nice, but it hurt.
It's the same thing we do in the hospital with people who are dying or who are sick or are hurting. We want to give them some comfort, but really we want to comfort ourselves. Because they're going through something distressing, it makes us feel bad that they are, and we're feeling bad. So what we want to do is say, "It's all going to be okay," and it might not be,
right?
You know, and so we want to give this sort of false comfort, just because we want to be nice, and we don't realize the way that niceness impacts the world.
It can wound.
That's why they say that great thing: the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
They don't say it's, you know, it's paved with bad intentions that lead to good impact. They don't say that.
All right. Number 7, take breaks for self-care. This is so critically important, particularly for those engaged in any kind of work to dismantle systems of oppression, it's really not all on your shoulders. And you need to take breaks and you need to take care of yourself and you need to find time to love yourself and indulge yourself if you need to. And rest, right?
One of the most radical ideas I've heard on this, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Ben, is that there are times when you need to withdraw into your core community that you have this struggle in common with, and you need to not be in a diverse community. So, for example, there are some times when trans and queer people just need to be with other trans and queer people, and that's really life-giving, and they don't need to have straight people in the room because that's not helpful for them all the time.
Yeah.
I think it works that way with whiteness as well. Maybe sometimes people of color just need to not have to be around white people, and they need to commune in the very particular way that they can commune. I know that cis women feel this way as well. Sometimes it's nice to just have a particular conversation, an evening, a moment where you're with people that may have had a very similar embodied experience.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that we segregate all communities or that's the model going forward. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something to be said about being with your people and having that be okay and not having people say, well, I want to be a part, you know, like me, they don't need to deal with you right now.
Right. That's right. Well, and we get this sort of counterintuitive because we get a little anxious about groups that are homogenous because we think homogenous groups is how we got to where we are.
Right. Right.
And in reality, that's not exactly the case. It's been mostly violence that's got us to where we are. So sometimes it's nice to free ourselves of this illusion that we have to always be totally integrated in diverse, perfect, beloved community all the time, and that's always easy for people and not completely and totally exhausting.
Right, right.
Or causing harm. So like, there's sometimes where like cis straight men need to be with white men, need to be hanging together and saying like, hey, what are we doing as cis straight white dudes? Like.
Right.
We're running all the banks, so
but
seriously, like, we're running the world. Like, could we do something different in the way we're doing this that would open up more opportunity, that change things? What does my soul look like? Mm-hmm. How am I working on my soul? And can I be – I think we can be more honest in those settings because we can trust those folks a little bit more, a little differently.
Especially if you were getting together with – some cis white guys and talking about toxic masculinity, you could share things in the room that would hurt other people to hear, but it would be a way that you could grow together in that space.
Right.
But if, you know, I was there, it would be like, oh, this is causing me anxiety. That's really hard for me to hear about.
Right.
Now I feel a little sad.
Yeah.
But it's still important for you all to get to share that together and use it as a way to grow.
Well, and one of the guys can ask like that hard question, which is, goes back to this practices that she's asking us, is like, well, what about false accusations? Well, we can deal with it instead of it being like, oh, God, this is like not helpful.
But I would
don't
be
say
like,
that.
Are we really saying false? You know, like, it would be really hard for me, but I want people to be able to talk about that in the right setting.
Right.
I don't want to deal with that emotion.
Yeah, that's not fair to you.
Right.
Keep going. Let's go.
Interrupt attempts to derail. I think this happens a lot where we say, you know, you're talking about one particular situation and you say, well, what about black on black crime?
Yeah.
You're like, that's not what we're talking about
here. I hear that
all
the time. It's just, like somebody's like, well, what are we going to do about inner city violence? You know?
Well, you're not going to do anything
rap
about
music.
It because right now you need to deal with your whiteness. So let's get back to that.
Yeah. As if black on black crime is not a a consequence of systemic oppression.
Right, and as if no one in the black community has ever said anything about that or hasn't been saying something about that
or
for
as if they're not
years.
Working on it in
or
Chicago.
Or as if they're not actively working
right,
on it.
In other places.
It's so disrespectful to leaders of those communities.
It's very unhelpful. Yeah.
Sorry, I got really worked up
no,
about
the,
that.
I mean, but the disrailing happens all the time, and a lot of it is a way – it's a deflection.
Yeah.
I see it as mostly deflection. Let's deflect this over here. Oh, some people are upset and might leave, so let's talk about that. No. Let's get back on issue.
Right.
Racism. You know,
yeah.
oh, these people are upset about it. Let's get back on here. Well, what about this? You know, this we do this a lot with white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
One way is like, well, this person's poor. They're not privileged. Well, they're still white.
Yeah. I was poor growing up. And again, we'll talk about this in our race narratives later, but I was treated very well by the police in my neighborhood. And it's only looking back that I understand how those systems really work. And now I see everything that happened in my childhood very differently than I did at the time.
Little did they know they should have arrested you.
Get me out of the system.
All right, let's keep rolling.
Remember that personal attacks, name-calling, heavy sarcasm, and general unkindness are helpful. Right, and so she's not saying you have to be nice, but clearly there's a difference between engaging someone respectfully and calling them a name.
Right. That's
right. We're not advocating for that.
No, we don't want that. Practice unapologetic inquiry. I said appreciative. That's interesting. She sort of has the same thing, which means kind of being vulnerable with our questions, I think, and listening to others. Have conversations based on what was actually said.
That gets back to your appreciative inquiry as well.
Yeah,
you know,
like
repeat back to make sure you got it right.
Did I get your question right? Mm-hmm. Is this what you really said, or am I just making up in my mind what I think you mean?
Mm-hmm. Assume the best about one another. And I think this gets back to understand that we're all communicating systemic things that we've internalized. We can attack the system without attacking the person.
Yes, that's why John Powell says hard on systems, easy on people.
Mm-hmm.
Be easy on people, but hard on systems. Celebrate difference. I love that, and I think we need to do that more often. I have a great story about that. So at one of the preschools at one of my previous churches, I won't name which one, they had a number of huge issues, but they had a very diverse school. It was really cool. They had folks from India, and it reflected the diverse population of the area. However, they had every year a celebration called Cowboy Days.
Oh, no.
Where they put pictures of white cowboys.
I'm that parent who's like,
all over the walls and the Indians. And then they had this huge, big presentation. All the parents would come and watch the kids play out Cowboy Days. As if
Did
that was like.
Did they murder all the native people?
Well, it was
part
kind
of that?
Part of the story. That's not, that wasn't, they were kind of whitewashing over some of that.
Yeah.
Literally. And so I proposed this idea. Why don't we have like a celebration of everybody's culture, and like you pick a month and find out what the cultural and religious backgrounds of your student body is and celebrate the culture of that family each month throughout the year. Oh, no, they were not interested in that celebration process.
Oh, the cowboy Indian thing is
Cowboy
really
Days is bad.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm like, I have some pictures to show you that we took in the 19th century. It's not pretty.
Yeah, don't show them.
Taylor also says, ask who is not in the room. And I think that gets us beyond colorblind, melting pot, nice,
that's
no
right.
problems here. This is when we look around and say, who's not represented here? How do we change that?
That's right. Last one for you to take away. Make the goal of the conversation radical, unapologetic love.
So can we read the Che Guevara quote here?
Yeah.
Which people are like, but listen to what he said. At the risk of seeming ridiculous, let me say that the true revolutionary is guided by a great feeling of love.
It's hard for people to believe that because they imagine that revolutionaries are just trying to tear it all down and they don't care what the consequences are. But almost always the revolutionaries are trying to tear it all down because someone was being oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to, out of love for their oppressed brothers and sisters, they're trying to tear down the systems of oppression. And some want to do that violently, and others don't. And we get really anxious about violence that is not state-sponsored, CIA, Defense Department violence.
And we don't consider that violence.
That's not violence. That's just nice. That's just nice, you know, foreign policy.
Being a world leader.
Yeah. But we really don't like revolutionary violence, and we don't even like protests that incite violence or that might lead to violence. Like that's what King was accused of by the White Citizens Council and others, white pastors, is you're making the world more violent by just talking about this issue. And he's like, I'm out here marching peacefully with no guns. Like,
right.
You know, we're not right. hurting anybody just because they're reacting violently. That's not my problem. That's their problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have to do a critique and an evaluation of our violence. What kind of violence are we okay with? Mm-hmm. We should be okay with none if we're Christian. But right. a lot of us have made caveats and exceptions for particular kinds of violence. And the violence of a revolutionary is no worse or better morally, categorically, than state-sponsored imperial violence. Mm-hmm. And we have mm-hmm. to wrestle with that. Yeah. That's a real struggle.
Yeah, and I think the type of violence that we end up holding up keeps our privileges in place.
That's right.
You know, when we don't mind how the police police other neighborhoods.
That's right. Well, we want to leave you with these unapologetic practices. I think they're practices. And we want you to think about it, walk through them, read through them, and see how you might need to shape your life in a different way. And we hope that it will liberate you from the tyranny of niceness.
And allow you radical self-love.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.